Amen. Thank you so much. Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for welcoming me to your church. Actually, my boss, Amy or Ewing, her and her husband, Frog, were here for a number of years. So people who've been here for the last 10 years, you might remember them. I just got a text from Frog in all capitals, if you know Frog. Well, his name's Frog, so that gives you a start into his personality. But he, in all caps, he said, "Please send my love." So hopefully I've conveyed that in capital letters. But it is really great to be here. I've heard so many stories across the years working at the Zacharias Trust about this church. So it's wonderful to finally see it in person. As Jenny said, I work for the Zacharias Trust, where Frog and Amy are as well. And the organization exists to think about the big questions of faith, and particularly the Christian faith. So to think about any objection that people have to faith in God, to theism, and in particular to the claim that Jesus Christ was God incarnate and was resurrected from the dead and still lives today, and that this whole world that we live in was created by him, through him, and that the purpose of our lives, the purpose of our existence, is to know this God. So that's the claim of the Christian faith. And our organization, it's a bit of a bold claim, and I certainly can't say that tonight I have all the answers, so please let me just put that on the table. I definitely won't have all the answers. But this organization exists to look at some of those objections, and I was particularly drawn to this organization myself before I worked there, because I grew up in a Christian environment myself, but I had so many questions from a young age about whether or not Christianity was true. I remember being really struck once by the thought, well, what if I'd been brought up in a Muslim home? Would I be Muslim? I mean, I'm sure everyone at some point has thought about that. How much of our worldview is determined by what we've been told? How do we, in fact, know if anything is true? And as I've gotten older, this question has become more and more prevalent in the world of fake news. This is something I think about even more. I recently heard about a study that was done by an American professor at Columbia University, and he took a data set of, I think, 2.8 million online news articles that gets shared on Twitter. And according to this study, 59% of those news articles on Twitter that get shared have been opened and read. So this gives us a little bit of a window into the kind of world we're living in. People just share articles. I've been guilty of this myself. A great looking heading, a great picture, and you think, oh, that's newsworthy. And we don't even read them. And so how do we even know if anything is true? And this question really started to become something I found became really important as I gathered friends from other religions, from no religion, and I remember them beginning to ask me questions, particularly about the Bible. Why do you believe in this Bible? I remember the first time a friend asked me that, I think I was about 14 years old, and it hadn't really occurred to me to think about all the ways in which there was potential for the Bible to have been corrupted. You know, in the way the books were put together, in the manuscript tradition, there were so many ways, so many points at which the story could have been changed or added to, or other alternative stories about Jesus could have been gathered up and in some conspiracy, in a Dan Brown-esque conspiracy, burned. All these things started to come to me, and I thought, gosh, these are really good questions. And I think why I was drawn to the Zacharias Trust, but in general, actually, why I'm, I would say today, really confident in the Christian faith is because at the heart of the Christian faith is a welcome and an invitation to explore, to ask for ourselves that Jesus, the core of the founder of the Christian faith, the absolute core of the whole of Christianity, that he himself was someone who never turned a questioner away, who said that all are welcome, all questions were welcome. In fact, Jesus himself quite enjoyed asking questions. There was someone counted up, and there are, I think, 307 questions that Jesus himself asked. So Jesus is a fan of questions. So hopefully that gives us some confidence tonight that we're allowed to ask our questions. And you know, something else that really matters to me about Christianity and something I'm really grateful for is just another little interesting statistic. But in the New Testament, it's recorded that Jesus had no less than 157 one-to-one conversations. Jesus really valued people's questions, people's struggles. And he would take time to talk to each and every person. And I guess I wanted to say that tonight because it might be, and I think many of us have the inclination to think, well, why on earth would God, if there is a God, care about me and care about my struggles and my plethora of questions and objections that I have to him? Whether you're a Christian here tonight or you're someone who's just perhaps wandered in off the street and you're just curious, Jesus spends time, and the people who wrote about him thought it was valuable enough to record those one-to-one conversations. And I hope tonight that whoever you are, that you know that tonight there is a God who cares about you and your questions. He cares about me and my questions. And that we're all welcome. No questions off limits, no questions too difficult or too edgy, too disrespectful to ask, whatever it might be. And we're going to spend most of tonight just gathering those questions, talking together about them. And I'm hoping that that just carries on at tea and chips that we're having later. Yeah, and into the week and weeks that follow. Because the thing about truth is that truth can stand up to scrutiny. If something's true, you can look at it from any angle. You can ask any question. This is why our court processes, our legal system happens the way it does, because we believe that if you spend time asking questions, we can actually believe that we can, in general, get to something called truth. The opposite is true of a lie, and I'm sure all of us at some point have told a lie and have realized in that process that you really hope no one asks you any questions, because it gets more and more complicated. I think it was Shakespeare who said, I didn't write this down. At first we practice to deceive, something like that. I'm not going to try and misquote Shakespeare. Oh dear. I should have written that down. Sorry. Anyway, it's a really funny quote about the more you deceive, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. And then someone cheekily added, and after practicing for a while, how vastly we improve our style. But I think it still stands true that lies, when you tell lies, you're nervous. Please don't ask questions, because you know at some point it's going to crumble. At some point the contradictions will reveal themselves. Truth, on the other hand, welcomes questions. So actually we should be nervous of any worldview that says don't ask questions, simply believe. Leave your brain at the door, and on pain of death you just better accept, nod your head and say yes. And actually there are times, I think, as churches, as Christians, we've done this. And I just want to say I don't think that's what the Bible does. It's not what Jesus does. We're welcome with our questions. I wanted to say a few little things tonight about the Gospel of Luke, because if you haven't been coming along, if you're new here tonight, as a church, I believe you've been going through the Gospel of Luke. And I just want to have, as an introduction to our time of Q&A, just a few thoughts on why it is, when people have asked questions, for example, about this book and about, you know, this one of the primary texts, one of the four primary texts where we get told about Jesus and who he is, why we should in fact trust this. So would you open your Bibles with me if you have one? If not, don't worry. I'm going to read it out for you. So right at the beginning of this eyewitness account, and now Luke himself wasn't an eyewitness, but and we'll get to this in a second, but it's widely believed that he was writing down the words of of many eyewitnesses to Jesus. We're going to look now at what he even says right at the beginning of his own account. So let's take a look just at the first four verses of Luke chapter 1. So he tells us this. He says, "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who, from the first, were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things that you have been taught. So interesting, earlier the word certainty was mentioned. Luke tells us right at the beginning of this gospel that he has gone around, he has carefully interviewed people, and that he has recorded for Theophilus, and as was the practice in the ancient world, that this letter would be widely distributed, that he has recorded these things so that we can be sure. We can be sure that they are that they really did happen. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that we should trust this off the bat, but it's interesting to see that that's what he's claiming. He's not claiming that these are some emotional sort of experiences that some people have had and he just thinks they're beautiful, and so let's write them down and, you know, who really cares if they're true or not. We might think that. Some people might think that. Richard Dawkins might think that, although he might not add the word beautiful. Many people might think that. That's not what Luke says. John, similarly, at the end of his gospel, in John chapter 20, says something similar. And he tells us that he has written these things down so that we can know. And he said, in fact, there were many other things that happened, but he only had time to record this short kind of body of stories that relate to Jesus. And it's interesting, it's easy for us to look back. I actually studied history and ended up teaching history for a while before this. It's easy for us to look back in history and think, in a way, with a bit of historical snobbery, to think that people were just really, really gullible in the olden days. That they just saw people walking on water and they thought, oh, well, you know, yeah, maybe. Okay, great. They saw miracles happening as are recorded in the Bible and that they just believed them. I think, again, this is what a large proportion of even, you know, the secular Western world would think. Again, I would say to people who've said that to me, take a look at the Gospels themselves. Most people don't believe in Jesus because they don't think that, in fact, bread multiplies itself and people walk on water and that dead people rise. They know that if someone dies, they stay dead. Even people in the ancient world knew that much. And yet, Luke tells us, he's telling us, I know this is extraordinary, but I have gone around and investigated this. And the reason that's important is because he knows that these are incredible claims. These are incredible things. So why? Why should we trust this document? I'm just going to give you three thoughts on this, and then we'll go into a time of questions about a broader group of a set of questions that you might want to ask, philosophical questions or moral questions. We can look at those too. But just right at the start about these claims of Jesus, because this is so central. You know, if the Bible is lying, if it's been corrupted, if these things weren't true, then that's actually, we don't even need to ask the rest of our questions, because we can just say, okay, let's all head home. Let's go for a pint. Close up the churches. This is all rubbish. And in fact, that's what Paul says, who wrote most of the New Testament in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, if this isn't true, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, if all of what's been communicated to us in the Gospels isn't true, then we of all people are most to be pitied because our faith is futile. It is all based on these claims that Jesus was, in fact, God incarnate, that he spoke the words of God, that he came to earth to tell us who God is, that he died on a cross to do something about the deepest problems of this earth, of our hearts, and that in doing that, he's made a way to reconcile us to God so that we can know God, and that all of that is proven by his resurrection. And if that didn't happen, then maybe he said some good things along the way, but ultimately he was lying or he was deluded. And we shouldn't believe him. So in fact, this really matters. And I love that Christianity, in a sense, is falsifiable. It's quite unique as a religion in this way because it's not just recording a set of kind of good teachings that you subjectively might like or not like, or about a set of, you know, spiritual experiences. Now, it does include that, but primarily it's based on an event that either happened or it didn't. And that's why we should have confidence if we come to the conclusion it did happen. We can point to an event in history. This is something that happened. I love that the word gospel It means good news. It's not a good idea. It's not a good set of stories. It's good news. It's good news about an event that happened, that actually happened. What are the three things that you might want to think about when trying to think, can I trust the New Testament? Can I trust this book of Luke, that this eyewitness accounts, so to speak? Firstly, when you're looking at a historical document in general, the first thing you want to ask is the world... Oh, sorry, just checking if things are okay. Is the world that this document or this book represents real? Now, what questions would you want to think about that? You'd want to think about the geography. Does it record accurately towns? Does it have the right sort of understanding of the flora and fauna? Now, these things sound like jokes, but actually, we know that these Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were all written outside of Jerusalem. And Luke is a perfect example of how all of the details that he gets, that he puts in his book, are accurate, even down to the detail of how long it takes to walk from one town to another town. This is not knowledge that you would have unless you were actually talking to people who knew the town. Now, all of us know these sorts of things. You guys know the distance from here to Peckham Rye Station. If someone said, oh, it takes 2 hours to walk there, as a local, you would know, okay, there's something wrong. And it's really important to notice that Luke's Gospel accurately reports all of the details, as archaeologists have increasingly found out. In fact, Colin Hemer, if you like facts, here's a few little facts. The historian has identified simply in the last chapter of, chapter 16 of the Book of Acts, which is the sequel. Sorry, I know I'm talking fast because I need to get to Q&A. The sequel of Luke's Gospel. He also wrote Acts. Just in chapter 16 alone, there are 200 sort of historical facts that have been proved through archaeological digs and so forth. If you're interested in Q&A, we can go into what some of those things are. But they're even down to tiny details of how in different parts of the ancient world, leaders were called different things. They were called the chief man or the proconsul. And he gets, in every single city, he gets the different name for that, the leader of that place, accurately. That's the sort of detail we're talking about. That's the first thing you might want to know. And I had a whole bunch of really cool slides that, again, I'll show you later in Q&A if you're interested. But they're pretty sure they found Simon Peter's house. It's really cool. They found Christian graffiti from the first century, proving that there was a Christian group that met there. They found little fish hooks underneath the ground, showing that it's probably fishermen who lived there. They're pretty sure they found the synagogue in Capernaum where Jesus preached. And these are archaeological finds these aren't Christian archaeologists that are doing this work and historians. This is work that's done by New Testament experts across the board. That's the first question. Is the world of the New Testament real? Yes, that has been undoubtedly proven. These people knew the world that they were talking about, so we know that these were eyewitness accounts because of the detail that they get right. Now, the second question is, are the characters real? Because even Harry Potter describes a world, you know, King's Cross Station appears in Harry Potter, but is Harry Potter true? No. One of the reasons we know is because Hagrid doesn't exist. What about the characters? The characters real? Again, yes, this is something that we have accurately attested. In fact, there are 13 ancient sources. Now, that might not sound like a lot, but from classical historical perspective, that is loads. There is so much more attestation for the major characters within of the story within the Gospels than for any other ancient story that we have. 6 of those 13 sources are non-Christian sources. So, and that's far and away enough to confirm to us that the major characters of the New Testament were real. And it goes down to the minor characters as well. If you're interested in this, there was, again, a fascinating study done by a German scholar it's called the Talalan Lexicon of Names in Late Antiquity, Part 2, if you ever want to go and look it up. But basically, it's fascinating because it maps all the frequency of names that are given in the New Testament next to the frequency of names. I think it's a 3,000 data set of documents across the world at that at that time in ancient Palestine, and the percentages of the frequency of those names is phenomenally accurate. So I think it's Simon. Yeah, Simon is the most popular name that comes up most frequently in the New Testament. It's the same across the whole data set. That's just an example. The New Testament gets things right all the time. So that gives us confidence to trust this as a historical document. And then the question comes, are the events real? Because again, you get Philippa Gregory novels that are set in the, you know, they get all the details accurate, but then what about the actual events? How do we know that they weren't made up? I'm just going to give you a couple of thoughts to end as we go into Q&A. There is no doubt, according to across-the-board New Testament scholars, that Jesus was a man who lived, that he was from Nazareth, let's start there, that he lived and taught as a moral teacher and a wise man. These are non-Christian sources that affirm these things, that he was widely viewed as a miracle worker, that he was condemned to death by Pontius Pilate at the request of Jewish priests, that he had a brother called James who was executed, that there was a man called Paul who had gone across persecuting the church, who, according to, for some reason, he claimed he had a vision of the risen Christ, suddenly, inexplicably, other than that, changed his mind and became the greatest advocate for the Christian faith and was martyred, and that we have multiple examples of martyrdom of Jesus' followers claiming that they died because they saw him. And we don't have one example of anyone recanting and saying, actually, I'm not really sure if I saw him, or actually, we all made this up. We don't have one example of that. And that Christianity grew rapidly for the next 300 years, despite being under heavy persecution and a minority group for the next 300 years. Did the events actually happen? There's lots more that you could think about with this. You could think about the criterion of embarrassment. There's so many times that the disciples say that they made stupid mistakes, that they denied Jesus, that they so often are recording what they did wrong. Again, that's just a question to ask. Why would they do that if they're lying or trying to perpetuate some kind of grand story that they're making up? There's so many little things like that. Again, little incidental details. We call them undesigned coincidences that actually prove events. There's six, even just across the one story of the feeding of the 5,000, where, for example, it says that it happened at this time of year in one gospel, and the other gospel, Mark's gospel, said they sat on the green grass. The grass was only ever green at that time of year, the time of year of the Passover, where they just constantly are just adding up. The stories are being corroborated. If you were a journalist, or if you were some kind working in a court of law, this would heavily weight towards saying these are true events that are being recorded. Okay, I've spoken really fast and already for way too long. There's so much more to say, and I don't know if you are as interested in history as me and you like reading lexicon of names and all that sort of thing. Maybe not. And you're like, okay, let's get on to the real important questions. But I hope that's given you just a bit of a taste as to why we should even take this seriously, why the gospel of Luke, which tells us about who Jesus is something we should actually reckon with as potentially something that explains our existence as a universe, our world, and us as people. I'm going to invite Jenny up. If you have questions about this, what I've just said.